Time now is 3 o'clock, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO FM. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. Today, Phil Mundy will be here with details about the Ted Stevens Day celebration. Juno's Beer Fest is coming up later this summer. Alan Mills will tell us about that event. And we'll talk to Amy Courtney and Brenda Wright from the Juno Audubon Society about this Saturday's July Nature Walk. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more coming up on a Juno Afternoon. First is National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Charges are being sought against the Lacouturay Harvest Camp in the Pinoki Hills in Wisconsin. The Iron County Forestry Committee voted Tuesday to seek civil and criminal charges. Mike Simonson reports.
2 months ago, this same committee voted unanimously to support a one-year permit for that same camp. But in the meantime, Iron County Forestry Administrator Joe Varis says they sent LCO a letter asking them to apply for a large gathering permit instead. Varis says this has nothing to do with the proposed iron ore mine next to the camp.
Absolutely not. To me, it's black and white. There's a county ordinance and there's county forest law. You know, as a forest administrator and land manager, I need to follow those laws.
County Board Chairman Joseph Pinardi says the full county board will meet next week. He expects they'll agree with the committee and order eviction papers to be served on the harvest camp.
Because of the fact that they've been there longer than 2 weeks and they have not applied for the large gathering permit, our state county forester administration are telling us that we're in violation to allow it to happen. So we need to do something.
But LCO camp spokesman Paul Domain says they never got a letter from Iron County. No letter, no phone call, nothing.
You don't just say, hey, something happened and we're not sure when it happened, but it kind of happened and no one kind of responded and we're not sure what it is. So we got to write a criminal complaint against this guy and cite him for something. What is it?
Iron County District Attorney Marty Lipsky says he'd be hard-pressed to think of any criminal activity at the harvest camp, only civil charges of violating county forest ordinances. Domain says treaties with the U.S. government guarantee them the right to hunt, fish, and gather in the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
Native leaders in Canada are demanding an apology from the Canadian government after revelations that the government ran nutritional experiments on Aboriginal children after World War II. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
The information comes from research by food historian Ian Mosby. He found that government researchers used hungry Aboriginal children and adults in nutritional experiments in the 1940s and 50s. Starving kids became unwitting test subjects involving vitamins, minerals, and caloric intakes. Some received nutritional supplements, others didn't, to see how a starvation diet affects the body. At one residential school, milk rations were kept low and dental work was withheld from some children to determine the effects on gums and teeth. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Sean Atleo, says Native children were used as lab rats in residential schools for what he describes as the most unconscionable, horrific testing.
We're talking about 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds being pulled from the homes that they knew, the language they knew, the food that they knew, where there was food safety and security, into an incredibly vulnerable environment where there was also incredible abuse, physical, sexual, and otherwise. And so this is another element of truth-telling that is absolutely required at this juncture. That is the only way forward to reconciliation.
The tests were conducted between 1942 and 1952 on northern Manitoba reserves and at 6 residential schools across the country. The historian's report says at least 1,300 First Nations, most of them children, were involved in the experiments. But some Native leaders believe the numbers are much higher. Atleo and other Native leaders say time does not absolve the Canadian government of responsibility. He says the lack of funding was behind Native children not receiving enough food back in the 1940s, adding that it's still a problem that exists today. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
During this month in 2012, First Nations leaders from across Canada re-elected Sean Atleo as National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Atleo was voted in during the AFN's General Assembly in Toronto on July 18th and began his second 3-year term as leader. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is seeking to fill two positions in our national studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We are accepting applications for a senior producer for Native America Calling and resource development specialist to sell underwriting. Full job descriptions can be found at NativeAmericaCalling.com. Click on Employment.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon, and right now I have Phil Mundy in the studio as well as Julie Spiegel. So let's go ahead and meet you guys. Welcome to KTOO.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
Can you just go ahead and introduce yourselves and what you do at NOAA?
Sure. I'm director of the Auk Bay Laboratories, and the Auk Bay Laboratories has seven facilities in Alaska. Five of them are in Juneau. And our headquarters, the one that everybody knows us for, is the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute out at Lena Point. So we're a federal fisheries lab, and we provide information on the status of fish stocks all over Alaska and the status of fish habitat all over Alaska for the Alaska Regional Office.
And I'm Julie Spiegel. I'm the Public Affairs Officer for NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region and the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. So mostly what I do is try to keep the public informed of what's going on.
Okay, so you both work at that Lena facility?
I actually work downtown in the federal building.
That's, yeah, sometimes it's confusing to people because we're divided into two parts. Because the regional office handles the regulations and they work with the fishing industry, they try to separate out the research part of it, the fish stock assessment, as we call it, because they want to keep that a little bit separate because that determines how much the industry can catch. So we've got two parts of NOAA Fisheries. We've got the regulatory part, which is the Alaska Regional Office downtown in the federal building, and then you've got the research part, which is out at Lena Point.
Okay. So how long has that facility been out there, the Lena Point facility?
We moved into the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in 2007. So we took we got the keys on May the 1st. And we've been out there since. Most of the staff didn't move in until the summer of 2007, and we had our dedication ceremony in August.
Okay, great. So you're both here today to talk about a special event that's coming up later this week. What is that event?
Well, on Friday afternoon, we're going to have an open house in honor of Senator Ted Stevens, because the next day, the very next day, Saturday, is Ted Stevens Day in Alaska. So we're opening the doors to the public at 2:30 in the afternoon, and we'll be on until 7 p.m. And people are welcome to drop by anytime. And we'll have not just people from NOAA Fisheries. We have people from the fishing industry, from the environmental community, just about every group that's interested in Alaska's fisheries and keeping them healthy will be out at Lena Point so that people can stop and talk to them and learn something about what we do out there.
Okay, so who should be coming on these tours?
Oh, I think it's definitely there for the family. We have fish tanks with all different kinds of marine fish in them. We also have a touch tank going, and that's a tank that is the height of your average six-year-old. And they can reach in and they can touch anything they've got the nerve to touch.
I think Julie was pointing at herself because
I really do like the interactive sea life touch tank. That's my favorite. I like to, you know,
to feel the creatures in there.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. And
if people are interested in a walkthrough, we'll have staff standing by to take groups of 10 to 12 people around to see different parts of the lab. We really do have a beautiful facility. It's one of the flagship properties of NOAA Fisheries in the nation. And we're sitting up right on Lena Point, so we have a beautiful view from the lab, and we have couple of places that the public can really enjoy that view when they come out to the lab.
Okay. So this is happening on Friday. You said because on Saturday is Ted Stevens Day. And what is the significance of Ted Stevens Day to the facility in particular?
Well, I'm often asked by people, well, why in the world are you named for a U.S. senator? Did he get you the money to build a lab, or what was that all about? Well, you know, the thing is, I can't think of another American who would be more fitting to be the namesake for a federal fisheries laboratory. Ted Stevens was responsible for a lot of the legislation that's protected our fisheries and brought the fishing industry into our ports and onto our shores. So we just wouldn't have any sort of fisheries nowadays without the efforts that Ted Stevens put in when he entered the Senate in 1968.
Okay, and it was named after him, did you say, in 2007?
Right. We opened as the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in 2007.
So I'm sure did he get to visit the facility?
He was there for the dedication, and we're most proud of that fact. And we're really glad, particularly given the unfortunate early demise of the senator. We're really really pleased that he was able to join us for that dedication ceremony.
Were you there for that?
I have been the director of at Lena Point since it opened. So that's since May the 1st.
So you're the first director there.
I am.
Very cool.
I'm the first director.
Okay. So I think it's very interesting if we sort of take a step back and talk about Alaska's federally managed fisheries. Today they're known worldwide for being amongst the most sustainable and valuable fisheries on the planet. And a lot of that has to do with Senator Ted Stevens, because he was one of the co-authors of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, which first went into effect in 1976.
Okay, so we often do hear the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Can one of you describe what that act did?
Well, the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 1976 wasn't the Magnuson-Stevens Act we have today. It's been reauthorized a number of times, and they are building new features into it every time they reauthorize it. But the key feature back in 1976 was that 200-mile fishing limit. And right after World War II, a lot of countries went fishing. A lot of nations put fishing fleets out. They thought that was the thing to do. And in those days, they could fish to within 3 miles of our shores. We had Russian trawlers dragging up Maine lobstermen's pots off the shores of New England. We had 10,000 kilometers of gill nets floating around in the Western Bering Sea. It's really hard to imagine a gill net that's 10,000 kilometers long. But each of these fishing boats that serve the motherships in the fleet could carry about 8 to 10 miles of net in their hold. So we had a lot of gill net out there, and people have who are under the age of 40 have never seen this or run across it, but the impacts of that were pretty severe. Particularly on salmon. People think of salmon as a freshwater species and something that the state of Alaska manages, which is very true. But the salmon had to get through that gauntlet of 10,000 kilometers of gill net to get home. And we think of Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. It's the premier salmon fishery in the state. They just finished a season where they only got about 15 million harvest, and everybody thinks that's a small year. Well, in 1973, in the entirety of Bristol Bay, they had 2.4 million salmon and less than 2 million spawners. And Bristol Bay has rearing lakes for salmon that are just huge. You know, Lake Iliamna has the surface area greater than Puget Sound. It's an amazing area. And to think of only 2.4 million salmon making it back to the shores and less than 2 million getting to spawn, it was just horrible. People really, really knew at that point that they had to do something. They really did. And We had had international negotiations going on since 1950. We put a treaty in effect for the North Pacific to negotiate high seas fishing, called the International North Pacific Fisheries Convention. And that INPFC was a really good forum for getting people to talk about conservation of marine resources and fishing. But when all was said and done, more was said than done. And so Senator Stevens' big contribution was that he recognized, perhaps it was because of his kind of pugnacious personality, but he recognized that if something was going to get done, the United States had to do it on its own. So he introduced legislation in 1971 to put a 200-mile fishing limit just for the United States to impose it. Now, other countries around the world had started to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1971, it wasn't a new idea, but the idea that the United States would, you know, would just simply pass a law and tell everybody to step outside of 200 miles. Now that was revolutionary.
Wow, thank you for that explanation. That was great.
That's some good background.
Yeah. Okay. So you're saying it started out, but now you said it's different than what it is now, the Madison-Stevens Act.
Right, because we had a lot of work to do, and Julie may want to comment on this, because this is on the regulatory side. Because remember, we were starting from scratch in 1976. We had no catch accounting systems. Law enforcement. We had all kinds of things that we needed to put in place in order to make sure that the 200-mile fishing limit actually worked,
mm-hmm.
and actually was able to conserve our fish stocks and allow our fishing fleets to fish in peace out there, basically, and bring the catch on shore. So, Julie, do you want to talk a little bit about what the region does with this?
Well, sure. The region, basically how it works is the Magnuson-Stevens Act set up 8 regional fishery management councils in our country. Here in Alaska, we work with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. And the Alaska Fishery Science Center, which the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute is a part of, all the scientists there work with a lot of partners, including the state and people from academia, to do the science behind our sustainable fisheries here in Alaska. And they provide that data to the Fishery Management Council, and they, through their committees, look at this, all the data, and come up with fishing regulations and total allowable catch. And then the council takes public comment on that, and then they vote on regulations. So once the council passes a regulation or a management measure, then it comes to the regional office, and we're the ones that actually write the language and implement that management measure.
Okay, so I mean, Ted Stevens just had this lasting, huge effect on Alaska fisheries and the federal fisheries.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, today Alaska's fisheries are worth billions of dollars to our nation's economy, and a great deal of that is to do with Senator Ted Stevens and others who have worked over the years so hard to make Alaska fisheries so special.
Right. Recall that the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which was originally called the Fisheries Conservation and Management Act, and Senator Warren Magnuson, who back in the 70s was one of the most powerful people in the Senate, was also interested in getting the fisheries wealth of the continental shelves into U.S. ports. So he and Senator Stevens teamed up. Senator Stevens brought his 200-mile legislation and to Warren Magnuson, and he was able to use his influence to get the first bill through the Senate in 1975. So it was the Magnuson-Stevens Act. So in singling out Senator Stevens, he was, again, one among many people who were working very, very hard in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s to impose conservation measures, fishery regulatory structure on the continental shelves off of the United States, the entire United States. And but Senator Stevens really had vision, and also he had tenacity. He could really get in there and slug it out for what he wanted. And so he not only got the Fisheries Conservation and Management Act passed in 75, he also developed this over a period of nearly 30 years into a the legislation that it is today.
Wow, thank you for that. So it's very fitting to be celebrating Ted Stevens Day at your facility. Have you guys done the celebration before?
We have not been able to do a Ted Stevens Day celebration before this. We, for one thing, the summertime is the time when all of our people are out gathering data, the data that they'll use to write the fisheries regulations during the winter. So we have sort of a light staff and lots of things to do. So the last couple of years we just weren't able to pull it together. That's why we're very very happy to be able to do that this year.
And whose idea was it?
Well, I think it was my idea, because people are not generally going to take on extra work, but I'm the director, so I'm the one who's supposed to pass out the extra work.
Okay. Have you heard some interest in this day so far, into going to the tour? And
yes, we have. Heard a lot of interest. We have a docent out at the lab. A docent's a person who interprets the lab to the public, and we have tours there that start at 1 p.m. every day. People can sign up. I think we're limited to about 10 to 12 people, something like that. But we also have people coming through all the time just to see the laboratory. Our atrium area, the area between our laboratory building and our office building, is open to the public from 9 to 4:30 every day. We have an observation deck, and we get a lot of people coming through, and people have heard about Ted Stevens Day, and they've been talking about Ted Stevens Day, so we're optimistic that folks are going to come out and join us.
And, you know, something I wanted to add to that, Phil, is that you mentioned that we have these daily tours at Tez Marie. We call it Tez Marie. And those start at 1 o'clock, but those are really only for people 16 years and older.
Okay.
But if you bring the kids out on Friday for our Ted Stevens Day open house, kids of all ages will be able to participate in the tour. So it's a really neat opportunity to bring the whole family.
Okay.
Right. Our daily tours are targeted towards older people because we also use the science on a sphere. Now, over at the Alaska State Museum, people may have seen that over there. It's basically a giant white beach ball that hangs from the ceiling, and we can project. We use four projectors to put satellite feeds from the NOAA satellite center in Boulder, Colorado, onto the surface of the sphere. So we can make it glow, we can make it look like the world, we can show you what the sea surface temperature is, and color-coded all over the world, real-time out there. And so our tours are oriented around the science on the sphere and what that can tell us about the oceans and the atmosphere and the laboratories and what they do, what they provide for the public.
Okay. Let's just go over the details again. The Ted Stevens Celebration Tour Day is this Friday. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And at 2:30?
2:30 to 7.
2:30 to 7. People can just come in at any time?
Yes.
During
right.
those hours? All ages, families?
Right. We'll have tables with displays and exhibits for people to find out more about marine mammals and other marine science.
Okay.
As well as, you know, the opportunity to get your hands in that little touch tank.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Phil and Julie, for coming into a Juno Afternoon. I really appreciate all your information.
Thanks, Lisa.
You're welcome, Lisa.
Okay, up next we have a writer's almanac.
And here is the writer's almanac for Wednesday, July 24th, 2013.
It's the birthday of mystery novelist John D. MacDonald, born in Sharon, Pennsylvania in 1916. He's famous for his novels featuring Travis McGee, a beach bum detective who lives on a houseboat that he won in a poker game. MacDonald started reading when he was a kid after he almost died of scarlet fever. He spent a year in bed, and there he read all the books in the library. He served in the Army during World War II and entertained his wife by writing her little stories in his letters, one of which she liked so much that she typed it up and sent it to a magazine where it was published. MacDonald had 4 months of severance pay when he came home from the Army, and he spent those 4 months writing 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. By the end of the year, he was making a living selling short stories to pulp fiction magazines. He used his mystery novels to criticize what he called American junk culture, fast food, bad TV, and suburban development. He said, "I am wary of a lot of things, such as time clocks, newspapers, mortgages, sermons, miracle fabrics, deodorants, pageants, progress, and manifest destiny." It's the birthday of Zelda Fitzgerald, born Zelda Sayre in Montgomery, Alabama in 1900. She met F. Scott Fitzgerald at one of the military dances where he was stationed in Montgomery. They went on their first date on this day, her birthday, in 1918. Years later, in a letter to Scott, she wrote, "The night you gave me my birthday party, you were a young lieutenant, and I was a fragrant phantom, wasn't I? And it was a radiant night, a night of soft conspiracy, and the trees agreed that it was all going to be for the best." It's the birthday of aviator Amelia Earhart, born in Atchison, Kansas in 1897, the first woman to fly alone across the Atlantic. She also flew solo on the longer flight from Hawaii to California, the first person to manage that hazardous route. Then, in 1937, she set out to fly around the world. After making it more than two-thirds of the way, she disappeared in the Central Pacific, somewhere near the international dateline. It's the birthday of poet Robert Graves, born in London in 1895. His passion was poetry, but he wrote novels just to support himself and said, "Prose books are the show dogs I breed and sell to support my cat." He wrote historical novels such as I, Claudius, as well as his memoir about World War II entitled Goodbye to All That. And here's a poem by Theodore Deppe titled The Russian Greatcoat. "While my children swim off the breakwater, while my wife sleeps beside me in the sun, I recall how you once said you knew a sure way to paradise or hell. Years ago, you stood on the Covington Bridge, demanded I throw my coat into the Ohio, my $5 Russian greatcoat, my Dostoevsky coat, with no explanation, simply because you asked. From that height, the man-sized coat fell in slow motion, floated briefly, one sinking arm bent at the elbow. At first, I evade the question when my wife asks, as if just thinking of you were an act of betrayal, the cigarette I shared with you above the river, our entrance into the city, your thin black coat around both our shoulders. Sometimes I can go weeks without remembering." The Russian Greatcoat, a poem by Theodore Deppe from his collection Cape Clear, New and Selected Poems, published by Salmon Publishing, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And this is Billy Collins, hoping you will join us here next time for the Writer's Almanac.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO FM. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. Right now we have Andy Mills in the studio, but before we get into his interview, I just want to say that we will have Sarah Brown in the studio later to talk about the Juno Symphony's upcoming season. Okay, Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today?
It's a wonderful day in Juno, so I'm doing great.
Okay, so what are you here for today?
Well, last year we had our first Capital Brewfest, the Rotary of Juno, one of three Rotary clubs here in town. Is always looking for new ways to bring events to the community and fundraise for local charities and also some of our international efforts, as Rotary International does around the world. And a Brewfest was something we thought would be excellent to bring back to our hometown, me and my wife, who had been a part of a Rotary club down south and done a Brewfest there. So this year will be our second annual Capital Brewfest.
So has Juno had a Brewfest before last year?
I know a Rachel Utzler, who had been at Alaskan Brewing. I think she's with the Jack staff now. She had done some Autumn Pour festivals, and she had done Harvest. So she had actually done sort of a Brewers Festival, but this is sort of a larger effort to bring a larger selection to the town and perhaps a more conducive format to the general public rather than maybe just the beer aficionados.
Okay, so I wasn't here for last year's festival. Can you tell me about it?
Sure. So we had we were shooting for around 250 folks, and we had an overwhelming crowd participate last year. We had over 500, about 550 folks total. So overwhelming response, and they all said, can we make it larger? Let's do this again. And so we're certainly excited to have the second annual Brewfest this year, and we are shooting for a slightly larger attendance. We're still doing it at the Jack because they were excellent partners. We are still partnering with Saga, which is a great local program for involving youth and young adults in activities here in Southeast. And we're shooting for 750 tickets, so there will be a limited entry. We sold out last year, but we certainly have a lot of brewers lined up, food vendors, Spinning Pig. We talked to the other day, and they were excited to participate again, and some local bands as well.
Okay, so people buy a ticket. They walk into the Jack. What date is this?
It's September 14th, and it'll be from 1 to 5 p.m., which
okay.
is a great window because people can come to the event and then go to dinner or stay downtown.
Okay, so you walk in, and then what do you see? What's around? What's in the festival?
Sure, you come on in, and you either prepay the ticket, assuming that we still have some. You could buy some at the event. We give you a glass, which you can take with you, and it'll have the date on it this year. Last year, we weren't sure there would be a second annual, so we just did Capital Brewfest. And you go into the event, and we'll have a lot of pods where brewers from across the state and also distributors that'll have beers from around the world will be able to pour 2-ounce pours. And unlike last year, we won't have tokens this year. You go and grab the pours that you want from any of the booths, and we're there for 4 hours. Go outside. There will be an outside area where the food vendors will be and live music there at the event to enjoy.
Okay, so is the glass the size of 2 ounces then?
The glass will be 4 ounces, so you'll get it half filled up when
okay.
you go to a booth. And there are going to be so many selections, you'll kind of have to pick and choose what you would like to sample. Last year we had some gluten-free beers.
Wow.
You had a chocolate porter. There were some really interesting offerings last year, an apricot ale.
So how many brewers were there last year?
We had 10 pods total and around 65 different beers that were poured.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was an amazing assortment early on for our first festival. And this year, we anticipate having a few other folks participate that didn't have the chance last year. So obviously Alaskan Brewing, our hometown pride,
nice.
Will be pouring there. Broken Tooth from Anchorage also was last year. Denali Brewing from Talkeetna, which is a great offering. Haynes Brewing has confirmed, so they'll be there. They were there last year. Midnight Sun, also from Anchorage. And we have the distributors K&L, Odom, and Specialty Imports, which bring beers from all over the lower 48 and around the world. So you really have a great diverse offering. And we do have notices out to some really amazing brewers that were not a part of last year, but we've tentatively heard, but we're waiting to confirm.
Okay, so each brewery brings a sample of their beer, not just one.
That's right. They bring several, anywhere on the order of 2 to 5 is typical when a brewer comes. And so if you take 8 to 10 pods, you have quite a few beers there, and then the distributors will, let's see, I think Specialty Imports last year brought 36, almost half the beer offered.
Wow.
They brought a huge selection, and it was a very wide range.
So did any beers run out?
Well, certainly, yeah. That some of the taps ran dry. Because we didn't know the first year how many folks we would get and what kind of reception, we were certainly very happy to get what we did. Some of the beer that was brought was kind of distributed afterwards to some of the folks who had helped at the event. But this year, I think we'll have a better handle on how many folks will be coming. And so it'll be $30 a ticket. And we also have $5 tickets for designated drivers, because that we also feel is important. Some folks are not beer folks, but they still want to come and enjoy the food or the music or be with their friends.
Okay, so, you know, wine tasting has been around for a while. People mm-hmm. kind of know, like, what you do with wine. What's an appropriate way to taste beer?
Well, it depends on how serious you want to get, I suppose. But for a lot of folks, ale versus lager, they will kind of taste it and do the where they're trying to get the aroma and maybe smell the glass before they even try it. So it's probably to each their own. But with the selection that we have at the event, you can really get sort of the particular types that you really want to go for. If you like the darker beers, you can sample just the darker beers. And it seems like microbreweries and the brewing community around the world in general, they're kind of taking it to a new level of appreciation. And so this is kind of bringing that to Juneau.
I can't believe this event hasn't been here for decades and decades and decades. It sounds great.
Yeah, we're very excited to continue this here in our hometown, and hopefully folks will look for us to make it larger and better in the years to come.
Okay, so you're saying this is September?
September 14th,
okay.
From 1 to 5 p.m. at the Jack.
And tickets are on sale now? Or?
They are. Well, we started offering them at the beginning of July, and you can go to capbrewfest.com. You can go down to the Jack and get tickets from them, or I believe they also have them at Hearthside Books, Rainy Day Books, wherever the Jack sells their tickets.
Okay, and you're saying grab them because you guys sold out last year.
We did. We unfortunately had to turn a few folks away, which we don't like to do. So please do feel free to buy those tickets ahead of time to ensure that you can come and enjoy the event.
Okay, and last year you said there were 65 different beers?
Around mid-60s, yeah.
How many did you get to try?
Oh, myself working the event, I think I tried 2. So not heading it up this year, I certainly hope to sample more.
Okay, and then in general, what's your favorite beer?
I tend to like, I'm a Guinness man myself, but there are a lot of really, really interesting things that you probably can't get as often, but it'll be interesting to try. And then at all of these booths, you'll hopefully be able to find out where to get these beers here in town.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Andy, for coming in and telling us about the fun event. And I would suggest people grab up those tickets soon.
Thank you very much.
Well, I was only 8 years old the first time that we met. A couple of years too young to appreciate you yet. We met up again at age 13. We finally got it on. If you know what I mean. I never will forget that fateful rowdy night. The phone call from the police really gave my folks a fright. From that evening on, we were best friends. And this is the story of how this love affair begins. And her name was
Beer.
We met a long time ago.
Beer.
But I was too young to know
Beer.
That you'd be my best friend.
Beer.
We'd be together till the end.
Free beer.
You're my favorite kind.
Beer.
But I don't mind buying. I'd live on beer if I could. Cause I never had anything so dang good.
Beer.
We were classic high school sweethearts, and we're still together now. You win my heart back every night, but I can't remember how. You like going strolling hand in hand, and I try to keep a firm grip on your little round cane. And her name was
Bear.
We met a long time ago,
Bear.
But I was too young to know
Bear.
That she'd be my best friend,
Bear.
We'd be together till the end.
Free Bear.
You're my favorite kind,
Bear.
But I don't mind buying. I'd live on beer if I could, cause I never had anything so damn good.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Right now we have Amy Courtney in the studio and Brenda Wright. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon.
Hi, thanks. Thank you.
All right, so you guys are here to talk about the Audubon Society, and you guys have a special event coming up on Saturday, I hear.
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so can you maybe tell us how you're involved with the Audubon Society?
Well, I am the field trips chair, so I organize different little excursions throughout the year, the spring bird walks and then the Saturday wild walks in the summer. And Brenda here is the president.
Yep, and so I'm here to encourage Amy to, she's doing such a great job with our field trips. It's really a fun thing, and they're free, and everybody's welcome.
Oh, wow, okay. Okay, so let's talk about the Saturday event.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys doing?
Well, we are doing a nature walk up on top of the tram. Linda Nicklin is a wonderful naturalist, and she is going to be leading the walk. And it is free to the public. It's $7 a head, but if you're familiar with the normal fare, tram fare, that's nothing. And she's going to be talking about the birds and flowers up there, all the alpine flora and fauna, and it should be great.
Okay, is Linda a local Junoite?
She is. She's a really good naturalist that works here in the summer, but she follows the whales because she does the whale research also. So lucky Linda, she goes to see whales in the summer in Alaska and Maui in winter.
Okay, so she's really familiar as well with the birds here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she's an excellent birder. And the fun part about this is that we get to go up at 8:30 in the morning on the tram, and that's a little bit before the public, so we'll actually get to go up. Be up at the top up there and get to see the birds and some of the animals without being disturbed by other folks before we get there.
Okay, so what makes that area in Mount Roberts better for birding or better for nature, or is it better?
Well, the alpine has a different group of birds. You know, there's the things like the ptarmigans, like our state bird lives up there, and the grouse. It's not so much it's that they're especially different birds, but they are all birds that we don't see commonly at saltwater, and it's easy to get there by the tram.
Okay, and have you guys done this event before?
Yes, this is actually our 7th year.
Okay, and what's usual the crowd? How many people usually come?
Oh, 35 to 40.
Okay.
But it helps. Since Amy was so good about getting us on the radio, I think maybe we should probably have that many people come.
Okay, so when you have big groups of people coming, bird watching, do you have to sneak up on them, or?
Yeah, well, it is a little bit more difficult when you have a large crowd because, you know, people like to socialize also at the same time. So, you know, it's difficult, but it's different, obviously, than birding when you're by yourself or when it's a very small group. But it has its own place, and it's fun, and it's you get to see more birds that are farther away, perhaps. You know, and maybe a few people will see the birds that are close and before they fly away. But usually if it's a large group, you know, you'll have different people will see different birds, and usually the leader will say what bird was just seen, so you can keep an eye out for it. So, yeah, it does have its challenges, but it's fun, too. So.
I really think of having more eyes just helps, too, because you might not see the one on the ground because you're looking at one flying. And so it does, I mean, there's going to be other expert birders along, too, So even if it's a large group, any other five birders, there are going to be some really good birders close by your elbow.
Okay, so you expect to have people who are part of the Audubon Society participate?
Yes, I think at least...
five or eight of the best birders in town will also be there. So
yes.
Linda may be the best of all possible interpreters and guides for flowers and birds, but there's going to be other experts along also.
Okay, and how about people who, you know, who maybe haven't gone into birding? How would you encourage them to come on this walk?
Well, that's an excellent question, because we've been teaching, our education chair has been teaching beginning birders to the adults of the community through community schools, and they're perfectly welcome. We totally invite beginners to come. We have extra binoculars for beginners. We would like to encourage people to enjoy our birds. So please do come. If you're a beginner, we'll help you learn a few new birds.
And what does it take to be a birder? That's an interesting question. Well, you know, I think the awesome thing about birding is that there are so many, you can enjoy birds at any different level. You know, you can enjoy them just looking out your window at a bird feeder, or you can be really hardcore and chase them down all over the world. You know, there's a huge spectrum of enjoying birds, and any one of those little spots is legitimate along the way, you know, of however much you enjoy birds and however much time you're able to invest into them. The important thing is appreciating them, you know, and appreciating where they fit in our world, you know, and their beauty and their songs. And it's, yeah. So people who come to this event on Saturday, they'll get to go on the tram, they'll get a nature walk, they'll get to hear about the different birds. Will they learn about, like, the sounds they make or the names of how to identify them?
Yes, in this modern world, we have apps that do all of that. And we'll certainly have those along, and we do, if you see a bird or you hear a song and somebody wants to say, well, what does it look like? Well, there's an app for that. And so we can bring up that bird and show them photos, and they can listen to the song again and re-recognize it and help. It's a very helpful thing to do, and then we'll keep track of all the birds that we actually hear and listed on eBird. You want to tell her about eBird?
Ooh, eBird.
Sure. So eBird is an awesome website. It's a citizen science project based out of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. And what it is a database, essentially, of people's observations of birds all around the U.S. and actually all around the world now. It's gone global. And so what you do is, say, I want to go birding on the Dyke Trail. I'll start my little list and take note of all the birds that I see or hear and how many of them and the time that I spent there. And then I'll just upload that information onto this website. It's super easy to do, very easy format. And once I've done that, that information is for... it's in an accessible form for scientists to use. It's a great tool, and also you have access to all that data too. Mm-hmm. You can look at see how where different birds are all across the U.S. Where different birds have been seen in Juneau. When was the last time a cedar waxwing was seen here in Juneau?
I don't know. When was the last time?
Well, I don't know. It probably wasn't too long ago. It was probably downtown, but. But these are all things that you can have access to through this site, too, and it's
cool.
Awesome.
Okay. How many different types of birds would we expect to see on Saturday's walk?
What a great question. In the summertime, we actually have about 100 species that could be seen in Juneau, but not all of them like that kind of habitat. So I would think that we'd probably see between 35 and 70 different kinds.
Wow.
If it's not too cloudy.
Okay.
I don't want to raise anybody's expectations too high.
Let's just go over the details again. What time should people meet?
Yes. So we're going to meet at the tram office down there at 8:30.
8:30 on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. And you might want to come a little bit early, because if the tram parking lot's full, you may need to park in the parking garage.
Okay, good point.
Yes.
And parking garage is free on Saturday.
Oh, another good point. And how long will this whole thing last?
Probably about 2 hours.
Okay, so people should schedule about 2 hours.
Yeah, the tram will be working on its regular hours after 9 o'clock, and so you could leave at any time after the beginning of the hike if you felt like going, or you can go to the top without us if you'd like to do that too.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for coming in.
And just a quick real thank
sure.
you to the tram for allowing us to do this on a nonprofit basis. Thank you
yes,
very much.
Thank you.
Mount Roberts Tram.
And the fee is $7 per person, preferably cash.
Okay, so thank you, Amy and Brenda, for coming in, talking about the Audubon Society and Saturday's event. Saturday meetup, 8:30 at the tram, and you'll be in for a great birding adventure. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. It's just after dawn in the piney woods of Georgia. Suddenly, from out of a hole 40 feet up in a large pine tree, pop 4 black and white birds. A family of red-cockaded woodpeckers is leaving their night roost. Native to the southeast, red-cockaded woodpeckers differ from most woodpeckers. They remain in cooperative family groups throughout their lives. And they excavate nests in living trees rather than dead ones, often reusing the same cavities for decades. To nest successfully, these woodpeckers need mature, open pine forests, a habitat requirement that has jeopardized their very survival as a species. When John James Audubon walked these woods in the 1830s, the woodpecker was abundant. A century and a half later, the federal government listed the red-cockaded woodpecker as endangered. Habitat loss is the problem. Most mature pines in the southeast have been cut down. The good habitat that remains is fragmented, and breeding woodpeckers are now isolated in ever smaller gene pools. Better management of federal forests and protection of the woodpeckers on private land can slow their decline. But much more needs to be done to ensure the long-term survival of this emblematic bird of the American Southeast. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have Sarah Brown in the studio. She's here to talk about the upcoming Juno Symphony season. Welcome, Sarah, to the program.
Thank you.
So right now, what is the Juno Symphony doing?
Right now, we're getting ready for our wildlife cruise, August 24th. It's hosted by Allen Marine Tours. It's a 3-hour tour that will be wildlife watching, and we'll have a string quartet playing on the boat, as well as a whole smorgasbord of yummies for everybody to enjoy, and John DeCherney and Specialty Imports will be there serving, wine tasting. So it'll be a lot to enjoy for 3 hours just to relax and enjoy the scenery and
listen.
Some food and some great music. So
members of the symphony will be playing.
Yeah, four members of the Juno Symphony will be playing. Lisa EBS, our concertmaster, is leading the group. I'm not sure what they have in store to play yet, but I'm sure it'll be wonderful. They're fabulous players, so we're really looking forward to that. So we hope everybody will grab those tickets. So
and
they're
when?
Not gonna, August 24th.
August 24th, okay.
From 2 to 5 p.m., and tickets are only $60, so that's a steal when it comes to the tours.
Yeah, definitely. And tickets are on sale now.
Yes, tickets are on sale now. You can get them at the Jack, or you can call the Symphony office, or you can go to Hearthside Books.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how are you involved with the Symphony?
How am I involved in the Symphony? I am the new executive director.
Oh,
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Val Schneider was there for 6 years. She did a wonderful job, and she's now the owner of the Brown Boots Costume Shop that is going to be opening next to Perseverance Theater. And she's been wonderful in getting me transitioned into the position. And It's certainly been overwhelming, but wonderful at the same time. I did my first concert, the Motown concert that happened at Centennial Hall. It was a total blast. We had over 800 people there, probably closer to, you know, 900. It was really great to see that many people there and just getting to know Juno, and it was fabulous.
So that was your first show as the executive director?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, that's great, because that was my first show to watch, the Juno Symphony.
Oh, great.
So
great.
You did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you. It was. I think fun was had by all, for sure.
Okay. You moved to Juno for this job then?
Yes, I did. My husband and I came out from Indiana. He has a job with the state, and I am a musician. And so I was looking for a job in the arts, and I saw the symphony opening. I said, it's perfect. It's exactly what I want. So we were very glad to be here and glad to be doing what, careers that we really enjoy.
Okay. So when will the Juno Symphony start their season again?
Our season begins in October. As you know, our conductor, Kyle Wiley Pickett, is moving on to Topeka and Springfield, Missouri, where he'll be the conductor of those two symphonies. But for the next year, he'll still be with us. And our first concert, though, will be conducted by our associate conductor, William Todd Hunt, which a lot of people recognize his name from Opera to Go and Juno Lyric Opera. He's conducting a concert of Russian romantic songs, scenes from Boris Godunov, which is an opera, and David Miller, another local Juno star, will be singing the bass baritone solos in that, and we'll finish up with the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 5. And then our POPS concert, which is usually in the summer, but this time we're going to have it in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And Kyle will be back for that, and it'll be at Thunder Mountain High School. And we're going to feature songs from the Wild West. So, you know, think spaghetti western and old John Wayne and Clint Eastwood movies. I think a lot of people will have fun with that. That concert will also feature our 2013 Youth Solo Competition winner, Ethan Side. He will be playing the piece that he won the competition with, the Mozart Concerto for Violin, number 4, Movement 1. Anyway, but that'll be great. I know a lot of people will love to hear him play. He did a fabulous job. I was there for the competition. He's sure to impress. Next concert would be, the spring concert. That's going to be fun because we're going to do a Dan Pinkston piece. It's an Alaska premiere. And then Lisa Ebius will be returning, our concert master, to play a solo work, Dvorak's Romance. And then we're going to finish up with the Mozart Requiem, which a lot of people recognize that piece. We're going to be using the Juno Symphony Chorus, as well as the Juno Box Society, because they're also having a big anniversary year for them as well. And our last concert is our farewell concert. It's Kyle's last hurrah, and it'll be a reprise of his very first concert that he put together with the Juno Symphony back 14 years ago.
Well, that sounds like a very exciting season,
yeah.
And I'm sure people are looking forward to it. In the meantime, they can go on this whale tour with the string band.
Absolutely, yes. Come on the tour and have a blast with us.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for coming in talking about that. We need to end our Juno afternoon this afternoon. Tomorrow, we're going to get a preview of this week's Food Truck Friday with Rick Trostel. We'll get a look at this weekend's performance of King Island Christmas. Ryan Scott from the Department of Fish and Game will update us on the bear situation in Juneau. We'll find out about Craig Joring's presentation tomorrow night about his missionary work in Mexico. Nancy DeTourney will be here with Arts Up, That Writer's Almanac, Music, and More. Thursday, that's tomorrow at 3 on KTOO News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay area, tuned to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9, and Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait here KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXL can be found at 873. Up next is All Things Considered.
The consequences that we have to live with are the army bullets turning to our flesh.
Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood braces for the military's plan to restore order. It's Wednesday, July 24th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. The Muslim Brotherhood fears a crackdown as the country's top general seeks public support for the army. Also, the strange bedfellows in Congress who oppose funding the National Security Agency.
I call it jokingly the wingnut coalition, where you have the right wing and the left wing working together and trying to get things done.
And how biologists are tracking elusive species by sampling the water.
And we can actually extract the DNA from this water sample and be able to tell that it's hellbender DNA.